Now this is my kind of party. Grab a friend, bring the guns. It's time for the Co-Opticast.
Hello and welcome to the Co-Opticast. This is episode 72 for Tuesday, August 30th, 2011. I'm Mike, and Nick is stuck in transit getting back home from PAX. So for this week, we're going to play for you an interview with Final Form Games that Jason and I conducted about a week and a half ago up in Philadelphia. So, enjoy it, and we will talk to you again in about 2 weeks.
All right, kicking things off here, we're here with Final Form Games, developers of the indie co-op shmup slash whatever else we want to toss on there, hit Jamestown, which currently is released on Steam, but I know that you guys are potentially looking at other platforms later on. But for the founders of it all, let's go around and just do some quick introductions.
I'm Tim Ambrogi. I did the core engine programming. I did a lot of the gameplay programming, and as you'll see as we go around, we all did the design of the game. And level design and story writing, we all participated pretty equally in that.
Good deal.
Yeah, I'm Hal Larson. I do a lot of the gameplay programming, do like a lot of specifically enemy stuff and just whatever else needs to be done.
Bullet pattern.
Google. Yeah, bullet patterns, like enemy state machines, stuff like that. I do, like, yeah, we'll come up with like a general design for an enemy as a group, and often I'm the one who'll go in and really make that work and make all the design decisions.
Fully implemented.
Have to,
yeah, cool. My name's Mike Ambrogi. I'm Tim's brother. And I did the bulk of the art in the game, as well as contributing to level design and core design and story.
So, starting things off, and I've already kind of looked at and read up a couple of interviews you guys have done with different sites, but not really so much the founding of this, but the decision to come indie. I mean, you guys were all out in California doing your own things with different companies and working on AAA titles. So why go indie? I mean, why come out here, start your own thing?
Well, I had a taste of it when I was working at Planet Moon.
Just a little taste.
Yeah, just a little taste. 3.5 months. I was allowed, due to whatever reasons and the zeitgeist of the game industry at the time, to do our first provisional iPhone game for Planet Moon. And because of the experimental nature of that, it was just me. And then later, my friend Steve Royer at the company came on for art. And, you know, we staffed up to maybe 4 people by the end on it, but it was really, it was essentially, I had full creative control. I was just in there with a concept that my other friend at the office, Chris Cornell, came up with, and they greenlit the idea. They're like, Tim, go make it. So I went in there, and I was allowed to really experiment and try new ideas and make some of the judgment calls myself that in the past I'd had to, I was sort of beholden to other designers. And I guess I realized that I really enjoyed the design part of things, but in the larger game industry, it's a rare and elusive thing to be able to simultaneously develop the product and have an enormous amount of influence on the design. Mm-hmm. So for me, having tasted that, I really wanted to go out and do a game that was more than 3.5 months long, do like a real full experience, full development cycle with that level of creative control.
For you guys?
I mean, it's interesting because I think that, you know, there's, we'd all kind of work together in various capacities, but not as like a three-person team. Like Tim and I have been making games together, you know, since we were kids. Mm-hmm. And I think our first kind of big boy project, if we could call it that, would be the Puyo Puyo SDL port that you made when you were like, you spent a week at...
That was our first, that was the first time I wrote in C++. That was my first, I would say, my first successful project that resembled a game.
It was like a full, yeah, it was a, you know, it had its front end and scores, yeah. And, you know, it was like a real deal product, and we made it very, very quickly, and I did all the art for it very, very quickly. Yeah, we did it in like a week. And so, yeah, you know, we had sort of experienced doing that and really enjoying it in the past. And then Tim and Hal had collaborated on things, as had Hal and I, sort of peripherally and remotely usually over the years. And so sort of coming up on the cusp of actually deciding to go start a company together, we spent maybe 6 months on the weekends, you know, getting together and working on prototypes and doing smaller scale projects and just kind of getting a feel for, like, you know, if we had ideas we were all excited about, if we could work well together as a group of three people instead of, you know, sort of various atomized groups of two. And, you know, all of that helped kind of build the confidence to go ahead and, you know, pursue.
Yeah, I mean, Hal's been doing indie games of a pen and paper role-playing for a while.
Like, yeah. I mean, I've been, you know, like these guys designing games since I was, you know, wee small. But usually more of a pen and paper board kind of variety.
Did a lot of level design, too.
Did a lot of level design for, like, Unreal Tournament levels when I was in college, just for kicks. And, yeah, I really enjoyed it, really liked it. Ended up working at Leapfrog after a hilarious...
Sorry, because you had the standard game developer...
Yeah, I had the standard game developer path, where you go from chaplain to... from hospital chaplain to, you know, educational student to...
Game dev.
But no, I was working at Leapfrog. I was doing a lot of work with their educational team on some of their sort of some really interesting projects, but I wasn't doing a lot of the game design and development, and it was, you know, frustrating to see, like, some of the things that they were doing that I wish that I could do, and so the opportunity to go indie and really flex those muscles was really, really attractive.
Cool. So along those lines, then, what does indie mean to you guys? I mean, having worked on these different things, what really is it about?
I mean, for me, it really is very subjective, as I'm sure you know. Mm-hmm. For me, it's really about the creative control and the ability to take risks. It's low stakes, but as a result of the nature of game development and the low cost of entry, it is high expressiveness. That is, with very low capital, you can really explore exciting ideas and share them with the world. Which is that confluence of things is rare. And right now, at this very moment in game development, you can, with almost no resources to speak of, create something that you have enormous creative say in and essentially create a piece of art to give to the rest of the world. So for me, that low-stakes investment with the high creative output is what I love about being independent of mm-hmm. all the things that I've been dependent on in the past.
Yeah, I think the creative control is like everything. You know, yeah. That's I've worked on really cool projects with really cool people before. You know, like I've worked on projects I was passionate about. I've like, you know, like that's what my AAA experience basically was. You know, it was like being surrounded by people I really liked who were super talented, working on games we all thought were super cool. And you know, that's not necessarily the crux of indie for me. The indie thing is like actually steering that ship and like, you know, being able to follow our noses towards what's going to be great and not being beholden to, you know, perfectly reasonable, but definitely more powerful than us, you know, people who have needs and that we need to meet.
And I do want to emphasize that it's also about the low-stakes nature of things. When you're optimizing your judgment and decision-making in a high-stakes environment, you will not optimize it the same. You make different decisions because they are, in fact, optimal in that high-stakes situation. If you have 35 people who have kids and they need to not starve and their families need to be supported and your company needs millions and millions of dollars, you can't just make any game and you can't cut the corners that you might cut. You can't invest enormous resources in things that ultimately won't affect the bottom line. Things change.
Right.
So the freedom from those constraints is a huge part of it because it lets you
swing for the fences.
Really do stuff that's crazy and you know will be fun and probably couldn't support a 35-man team, but could definitely give something great to the world.
So, all right. Decided to go indie and really looking for that creative control. And so when you guys started with this project, then which kind of chicken or egg sort of thing, which came first? Did you guys know that you're going to make a shmup, or did you guys just have an idea that you wanted to do something with this setting of Jamestown and this area, you know, kind of?
So the chicken and the egg is a very simplified model of that.
Yeah.
Imagine that there's like a 12-step process, and it's all 12 of those steps. Who knows which happened first? We had the story, we had the milieu, we had the genre, We had the game mechanics, all of these things just floating around in a jumble. Some of them really far along mm-hmm. in prototypes, some of them really just conversations. The story was just conversations for like a year and a half.
Yeah.
I mean, whereas Camellia we settled on pretty early on.
Yeah, and I'd say the shmup, I mean, I'm pretty confident saying that like we were committed to making a shmup prior to having our milieu.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
we were like, we're gonna do a shmup. You know, that was in our minds when we kind of walked in the door on day one. And having done, you know, it should be noted, a fair number of prototypes of games and other genres before we moved out here, before mm-hmm. we kind of pulled the trigger. We did some other smaller scale projects, and we had it on the brain. We were on a kick, and we were excited about that genre. And so we did a lot of prototyping in Flash while Tim stood up the engine, and that was when, you know, that was all kind of bootstrapping our ability to really make a decent shooter. Because, you know, we hadn't really done mm-hmm. that before. And you know, that side of things was pretty mature. Like, we've been on it for, like, a good number of months before we had, like, a kind of a formal meeting that resulted in
yeah.
the rough strokes of the Mars, the British Colonial Mars
and,
milieu.
Yeah. And we were still in the Flash for like, I would say another month or two.
Yeah.
Or like another month before we stood up the game and really started to make what became Jamestown proper.
Yeah, in the engine.
Yeah. I'll let you ask your next question, because I wonder which one it's going to be. It might just be what I was about to say.
We'll see. Because it probably is going to go somewhere else.
Okay.
Because it's actually, but I'm curious to hear what you're going to okay. say, too. My next question actually is dealing with, okay, so you kind of came up with it, and then the style of it all. And I saw from one of the interviews that you guys did, talking about how a lot of it came from, you know, Miyazaki films and Castle in the Sky and stuff like that. Yeah. So, you know, just more of curiosity basis, you know, looking at the style of the game, are there little, did you guys sneak in little nods, little things like that to all that? Like, you know, as you sort through particular fields, if you look carefully, you can see Miyazaki written in the corner.
You're asking, where do we hide the Easter eggs?
Yeah, though? I mean, I gotta tell
are
you.
Are we allowed to tell them where the Easter eggs are hidden?
I'm not gonna tell them about the Easter eggs.
Maybe we'll capture that later for the dev commentary. Just tell people, look really carefully here.
You know, it was funny, actually, we were doing those interviews and discussing things, and I'm really embarrassed to say it, but it's definitely true that, like, the light bulb of, like, realizing the degree to which I had been influenced by the things you just listed
yeah.
didn't come on until, like, after we shipped.
Yeah.
Like the game was out, and, like, someone was like, what are your artistic influences? I was like, I don't know, Metal Slug, and I'm like, right, yeah. this answer. And then I was like, I just watched Nauska, you yeah. know, with my girlfriend for the first time, for her, and I was watching, and I was like, oh, my God. Like, I couldn't believe how many things that I had
that's
done.
That's level 3.
Level 2.
Level 2.
Level 2 is like a scene out of the Nauska video
yeah.
game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, the enemy design. Like, that's the gun what that's ship. From. Like, I couldn't, it was like, you know, the... You know, the big twist moment in a Shyamalan movie or something. I was like, it was there the whole time.
So, and plus, you know, citing Miyazaki, you have the shmup genre, which has bullets flying all over the screen, and Miyazaki uses the whole canvas mm-hmm. rather than focusing something anywhere. So, even the mechanics of the game
sure,
reinforce the art style.
Yeah, he loves the pink bullets. Like, I really.
The real answer to your next film is Pink Bullets.
To your question is, you know, there are probably Easter eggs in there that, like, you know about that I don't.
So that's actually going to lead to, okay, you know, somebody cares about your game, right? So when you first did all this and were doing that, then what, I mean, for you guys, was ultimately the goal? And, I mean, like, are you there yet? Are you still pushing towards it? But what was the goal of this?
The goal of this endeavor?
Yeah.
The goal of this endeavor, it was GDC of 2010, we stopped and asked ourselves that exact question. I think we talked about it for like a week. Because, that was, you know, GDC is a time when you see what everyone else is doing, and you get a reality check, and you just have a lot of contemplative time as you're there in that environment. So we were like, what is our metric for success on this thing? What do we want this thing to be? And our answer was, we wanted it to be a game that when all was said and done, we could look back on and be proud of the fact that we had made it, and we could legitimately look anyone in the eye and say, this game is a lot of fun. That was what we decided at the end, was the only goal we really had control over. You can't force a game to be a financial success. The market is simply too unpredictable. To set that as our metric for success is throwing far too much to the wind. So the most useful one we figured was, is this a really fun game? Can we say that with confidence? And if it is, there's a high probability from what we've seen it'll correlate to financial success. But it just had to be something where no matter what, how it did in the market, we could say we did it.
We were prepared
to
walk
away.
Yeah. You know, it was something where I suppose we could have decided to make a game where we compromised on how much fun it was or how high the quality was or various other axes that were important to us, and maybe gotten it out sooner and tried to make another game and, like, you know, sort of optimize for different things. And ultimately we decided that, yeah, it was worth it to really swing for the fences and make it something that we think it is now. You know, like, we feel like we achieved that goal.
Yeah.
And we were prepared to walk away from the table knowing we had done that.
Yeah. If we went out of business, that would be okay. We did it.
Yeah. Our initial goal when we set out to make a game was to make a game that, you know, we would make pretty quickly, had an interesting premise, and we would release into the market and learned more about the market as we were making it. Dip our hands into the lake. As we were making it, we realized that what we were learning about the market was
that... Wait a second, that's my whole body, not the hand.
but you can't learn enough.
Just the hand above the water.
And the metaphor is that we couldn't learn enough without going in all the way. We wanted to dip our toe in the water, and we weren't going to know until we all...
We released, like, an unpolished, you know, really small-scale game. We'd find out how that kind of game does in the market, right?
Yeah.
But we wouldn't really gain the confidence to make the kind of game we wanted to make. Because really immersive, fun, coherent experiences. We really set out to make memorable experiences that... sort of attack you on various fronts, sort of emotionally and with music and with good graphics and great gameplay. This is something we all wanted to do. These are the games we want to make.
Mm-hmm.
So it was hard to see any way to learn how that would do in the market, but to do it.
Yeah.
So we just said, you know, if that's what we want to do, let's do it, and not look back.
So along those lines, what's been the hardest part of the development of this game? Because I know 2 years, right? 2 years of development time.
20
we anticipated you would ask.
Number one.
Let's see. So we wrote a bunch of things down. So one of the hardest things was the storytelling, which we wanted to disambiguate because we had to do that. It took us a long time to learn that we needed to disambiguate it from the story. The story is an idea floating in the ether, and the telling of it is what we found very difficult.
Because you guys could have just set out 5 levels and just pushed 5 levels out there that they're just like, hey, here's the setting, have fun.
Stuff's happening.
Yeah, which is, you know,
a lot of storytelling.
Historically, you know, how most of these games have been made.
Right.
And I don't want it to belittle that those games are doing storytelling.
No, yeah.
They're just not doing as much storytelling.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have this world, and that world is a part of the storytelling. But it's not providing much narrative. And we wanted to create a narrative, particularly in our game. We wanted to have it be, when you start a level and you play through it, at the end of it, you can tell somebody what happened. That is, who are you? Why were you there? What were you trying to achieve? What went wrong along the way? And did you achieve it? Did anything else happen that was interesting? That people would have answers to that, and that their answers would generally resemble each other's.
And that's one of the things, you had the woven sort of story, but what I really liked was at the beginning of each level, that little placard, that little thing that just popped up and said, okay, you know, in which XYZ,
such a big moment.
That was a huge moment. That was maybe the 15th idea.
Yeah.
We tried so many things to try to make a story stick. So, you know, I could wax philosophical about it all you want. I don't know how much you want to hear about this. Like, give me that.
I got a couple more questions I'm going to ask you about it, so...
Okay, cool. Well, I'll just go in a little bit of depth. And you can cut out what you think is maybe going in too deep. But one of the big things that we discovered is that information resolution per unit time and the presentation of it, like density in a visual space, is not something you can necessarily control. how much you are allowed, how much time and space you are allowed to use to tell story.
Yeah, the story bandwidth is determined pretty, for
it's
you.
Pretty non-negotiable, you know, in various contexts that the game puts you in.
For, specifically, if you are playing the game, you are going, and you are, like, going really fast, and you're, like, soaked, and your attention is all on dodging bullets, you can't put a chapter of narrative up.
Yeah.
But if you, a person is waiting for the level to load and is sort of cooled down and revving up, you have some time for them to actually sit there and read. And if they're offline and sort of looking for more stuff to do, they actually have quite a lot of time to sort of...
But even then, right? I mean, they're only willing to read so much, and, right, there's still a lot of limitations.
And that's not... But the heart of what I'm saying is really that they're only willing to read so much at any given point in time. They'll be willing to read a lot, for instance, after a level's done, during the cooldown, when they're like, I did it. And they have that feeling of, I did it, I pulled something off, I accomplished something, what was it? To then explain how well they did. Yeah. Oh, and they did this thing, and this thing happened because of what they did. Well, they're much more willing to listen and read there. Not a lot. If you've seen the stories, you know, we originally had them about 13 pages a piece. We had to trim them down to about five or six in the real stretches. But it's way more than we have in the chapter headings. And the pictures allow for a very quick scaffolding for the information to hook into, which was the second thing I was going to mention, is that we found that when you have very little bandwidth for storytelling, you can create hooks and anticipation and essentially a scaffolding for the understanding of what's going on, that they may not know what it is then, but as long as they remember that this, what the scaffolding is, they can hook into it later. For instance, we say, in which be-tentacled Martians, blah, blah, blah. When they see the first thing with tentacles, they know it's a Martian, because we said be-tentacled Martian somewhere. They just remember that phrase. But it is the connection between the idea of Martians and things with tentacles. And those little words that we put in there tie ideas together as you eventually absorb
prompted
them.
Prompted recall, yeah.
Exactly. So we essentially lay out a bunch, sort of a low-resolution map of what's going to happen. And then when it happens, you can take the high-resolution experience of your own playing and hook it in. And then at the end, we take some very high-resolution extra information that wasn't in the gameplay, and we layer that on top. And eventually, you actually have a fair bit of a sense of what happened. You feel like you played it.
Mm-hmm. We had none of this theory to start. Like, we started just trying to tell stories, and then, like, one day, I think we were sitting down and just talking about how our UI would work, and we really pounded out, like, exactly... We were like, this is what we've learned from our experience, this is what I know from, you know, studying education, this is what Tim knows from making games for people, and like we really ironed out a theory of presenting game and story information to players that I think really helped us get over the line.
Yeah, it was essentially, I was panicking about being able to tell a story, and I had this desperate proposal, which was, let's just put the story into the UI. Like, let's just, like, put a map of Mars and put the word Mars on it, and let's, like, put, like,
just
a picture of Mars in the background, and let's, you know, make it so they can't miss it.
Yeah.
So it's fundamentally there. You can't miss it. It's old-timey. Why? Because there's a parchment map, and it says Mars on it. That's how you know it's Mars. So basically, it was a desperate, like...
See, this thing called Mars? It's Mars.
It's like when they do product placement in TV now.
Yeah.
They make it so fundamental. It's not like there's a Coke that someone's holding up and drinking, saying, I like Coke. It's more like, we have to go chase the Coca-Cola truck. That's the premise of the show. You can't edit that out. You can't miss it. It's about a Coca-Cola truck. And in the same sense, we just interwove the story into everything, because that way you wouldn't have to read anything. You just get the story.
Yeah, I'm laughing only a little bit because we're listening to the Alan Wake soundtrack coming up here, and all of a sudden I'm flashing back to the Verizon ads during that.
But yeah, the idea was to make it so intrinsic to the experience that the reading was merely to enhance. The story would happen regardless. And that chapter heading, finally, in the beginning of the levels, you can't miss.
Yeah.
The words will be read by your brain subconsciously, and you'll hook into them later.
And I think I hesitate to say brilliance because you're all in the room and you'll feel I'm sucking up.
Yeah.
Things like that actually reinforce the stylistic choices you made with the art and the setting. It's like, you know, the placard saying, in which our hero does such and such, and that's it. It's like, that's like reading an old, like, it's Edgar Rice Burroughs novel.
Yay.
You got the John Carter of Mars stuff. I internally think of the game as John Carter of Mars meets Metal Slug meets Dodonpachi.
That's good.
Up high.
So let's rewind back to that goal question.
Actually, when
we can
describe what we wanted
in our press, right?
Yeah, go ahead.
I do think that basically we might have uttered those exact words back to back,
probably
at some point during development.
Yeah,
it's like John Carter of Mars meets Metal Slug meets Jodon Pachi. That's like what
we win.
Yeah.
It's like if Cave made shooters on the Neo Geo, this would be awesome.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Spot on.
Yeah, spot on. Anyway, so that's the story part. So,
something else I'd like to add about story that is, developing those technologies is very difficult and
those techniques, yeah.
Yeah, those techniques really. Those are not new technologies, like text.
but
I think of them as storytelling technologies. You know, it's like it's the confluence of those things. You know, that makes them work. But that took a really long time. Like the story was legitimately like as a feature on the chopping block for a hilariously large percentage.
It was up until it was on the chopping block until April of 2011, it was on the chopping block, whether there would be any of those story things at the end.
Wow.
Like, we were going to do the chapter heading.
Yeah.
But those story segments at the end?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a Hail Mary. Our friend came in and did the illustrations for them, like, because he
Anthony
wanted it to happen, and he was like, I'll help you guys out. I can see that you need more art manpower. And that's the only reason they're in there.
Yeah, if Tony Palumbo hadn't, like, offered to do six gorgeous illustrations for us, like we just wouldn't be talking about this feature.
Yeah, so and that was really hard.
So that was really hard.
We were talking about the lack of that feature.
Yeah,
like, why did
we be talking about all these things? And the other thing I wanted to mention that is not obvious when you play the game, is that it's incredibly rare that making a video game, like, you make each sort of part of the experience in sequential order.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, this game is no different. You know, we made level 1, and then level 3, and then level 2, and then level 4, and level 5, and so, even knowing what order those levels were going to come in wasn't clear. We didn't know level 3 was level 3 when we made it, you know?
Yeah.
It was, like, the second level we had made.
Yeah, the first two, we didn't have any of the story context for how we write stories for levels, where, like, each level has a beginning,
and
middle,
we were,
and
like,
end.
You know, talk about, these have, like, final art, you know, they have, like, a place where something has happened, they have enemies that look like something, right? And, like, we have no solidity on what's actually happening, and, like, who's doing this stuff, and, like, where are we? Like, all of that stuff was up in the air and up for interpretation. So a lot of the challenge of developing the story was we had these immovable pieces. Like, I was not going to redo all the art for what ended up being Badlands, right? So
right.
we had to kind of contort it into a shape that would, like, kind of hold together and then, like, you know, fill in the gaps and make a story that fit with all that. And that constraint space was very difficult.
Is
well,
exactly
I was going
to
say, because level 5, I mean, like, you look at the levels now, that they go through level 1 to level 2 to level 3,
mm-hmm.
even then going into level 4, level 5 breaks it, though. I mean, there's always that moment in a good game where it just breaks everything,
mm-hmm.
and level 5 does that for you guys, and so that's kind of where this was going with your storytelling, because it's like, how do you get from what looks like, okay, level 1, this colonial sort of
mm-hmm.
new colony, to then you go level 2 and into the prison and then there to now, this is just utterly different from everything else.
Yeah.
And you guys had that level before you had this story?
That level... let me give you the breakdown of how the story came about. Here's the cliff notes for how the story came around. We made level 1 and 2. We did have a story for the first level.
Yeah.
We had something to do with, I think, the...
Well, we made level 1 and 3.
Levels 1 and 3 we made. Level 1 was essentially what it is today. The colony is under attack by
Martians.
No, it was actually the Spanish. Automatons. The Martians were put in a reskinning of the level to actually have Martian characters because, A, we need to make some much more interesting new enemies for that. It used to be they were just the same enemies on Badlands. So then we went and we added like 3 new enemies or something to the level, reskinned all of them. 5 new enemies. There's a lot of new enemies to the first level. Oh, right, because the boss.
Yep.
The boss is completely different.
Yeah.
But we only put that in later when we had a sense of the story. Originally, like, the Spanish automatons, we knew the Spanish would be the sort of primary adversary, particularly the conquistador. And then we had this general idea that you would go into a temple at the end, and there'd be adventures along the way. You'd find a lost colony somewhere. But then we had this breakthrough. This was a major breakthrough. Where we're like, instead of trying to tell a whole story, this big, large arc, let's just focus on what each level can be and tell a compelling story for what happened in that level. And then, assuming that those are compelling in themselves, then create a reason for
how you get
give it a backbone and get create the plot linkage between those sort of atomic pieces of story.
So we had essentially what we did was we did a fuzzy backbone, then we made it very concrete narratives for each of the levels. And then we went back to that fuzzy backbone, which was basically good, and then we shifted around and made it much more solid. And then we had the shape that we wanted.
And then we looped back around. I mean, this is
yeah.
Like,
and then
a
we repolished every level.
It's a big part of what made it really work. Is like once that stuff was locked in pretty good, we went back to particularly level one, and we really threw the kitchen sink at it. Like level one, we were like, "This is the kickoff of the whole game. This is where we deliver. This is where people are like, that's where my $10 went." Like it had to be like totally selling the story, the milieu, the stakes, the quality of the production value. Everything had to come together there, and so that was. When we had that clarity, it was much easier to loop back in and be like, okay, this is the first level of Jamestown, and we really knew the answer to what that was. And it ended up being, you know, a significant amount of work, but I think that was a great place to invest it.
By the way, as a complete aside, Fuzzy Backbone, great band name.
Thank you. I thought so. I was thinking we should totally cut that out.
That's my Spinal Tap cover band. very cool. All right, so in the midst of all this, then, and, you know, probably about time to touch upon it.
Should I get my shot glass out?
Yeah, get the shot glass out. You've got all this stuff going on, the fuzzy backbone of the story and the levels. Why co-op? I mean, why not just make this a single-player game?
Well,
and go from there, because there's tons of questions I'm going to add, like, kind of branching off this, but why co-op?
Okay. We did not set out to make a co-op game at the very beginning. But what we did set out to make, which I realize in retrospect implicitly assumes we will have good co-op, is we set out to make a shooter that was everything we wanted in a shooter. And that includes a story you can actually follow that makes some sense at all. It involves an interesting milieu. It involves a learning curve that players can actually grapple with, and it involves being able to, and this is the part, play with your friends, even if they're not hardcore shooter players. This is a huge problem with the shooter genre, is that some games do multiplayer simultaneous, but they ultimately make decisions that are based around arcades where they're trying to get quarters out of people. And that's fine, that's their optimization space, but we're not beholden to that. And I think that that's suboptimal for playing with friends. So we said, in a particular conversation with my friend Chris Cornell, actually, who's the guy who I worked on that that game of Planet Moon, my little indie game.
So not the lead singer from...
not the lead singer.
He lives a double life. But I was talking to him about, you know, if we were going to do co-op stuff, how do you handle the problem where a player is in the game and he fails out. He's out of the game. You can't do anything that relies on two players being there anymore. Mm-hmm. If one player can just be eliminated utterly, then you can't do a puzzle that takes two people to accomplish. And I was like, you know, you'd really just have to invert the idea of life and death to do real co-op that wasn't just simultaneous play, but real cooperative interaction. And I went to the guys like, can we have a meeting? And then we had this big talk about, like, is that where we want to go with this? And we were like, yeah, that's fundamental to making co-op play that isn't just simultaneous play, is you're never out, you're never fully out, and if you're fully out, your whole team's fully out. That lets us as designers make a game that's co-op. Mm-hmm. Without that, it has to be a game that can be beat by one person, and in that sense, it's really just simultaneous play. Even if there's small interactions, overall success is no longer based on a team, it's based on an individual. Yeah. It boils down to an individual.
Yeah, because, I mean, playing through the game, and you know, I'm sure you guys read my review, is the biggest lacking point to single player to me is that it feels like I should be playing this cooperatively.
Mm-hmm. You are biased.
I am biased. but just as a whole, just even playing, you know, there's games, I mean, you know, Shadows of the Damned, Bastion, stuff like that I've been playing recently that I just feel like, okay, this really doesn't need co-op to go anywhere else with it. There's other games, though, where I'm just like, why isn't it here? And this was one of those cases where I was like, the biggest down point to me of Jamestown from a single-player aspect is that I'm not playing this with friends right now.
Uh-huh. And that really was our goal. That was what we thought. That was what we thought about every shooter that we'd played, was The biggest down point of this game is I'm not playing it with friends.
Yeah.
I wish this game would let me have a good time playing it with friends, but it never helps me. It makes it harder. Co-op is harder in Gradius 5 because there's four multiples and you're splitting them amongst two people, so each person gets two. It's just harder. You have a shared life pool. Everything is made harder by playing co-op in Gradius 5, for instance.
Yeah, it doubles
and
the number
wish
of people who are exposed to bullet threat, you know, at any given time. Like, it's
just that your moral liability and your firepower is only marginally increased. And so this was, our feeling was just like, why don't they let us do this? We're going to do this. Somebody should do this. Somebody should make a shooter that you play with your friends and you're having a better time than you were on your own. And that was the big motivation. We just were tired of games depriving us of this. So we had the same emotion, in fact, you did, and we still feel that way, only it's actually more fun to play co-op as opposed to you just thinking it would be more fun to play co-op.
No, it actually is. But, I mean, I have something to go on with that, but did you have...
He hit the point. I've been playing a lot of Diablo 2 again because I'm an addict, and
I love the game, actually.
Yeah. The
Diablo
3 is going to
ruin our lives.
The brilliant thing with Diablo 2, the Diablo series is when it's in co-op, they increase the difficulty of all the monsters, and they increase things like resistance. So it's like, you know, the immune to physical, and you all of a sudden have to deal with that. But they can't do that in a single-player game because certain classes would be completely stymied by the challenge locked.
Yeah.
So
they also have amazingly good co-op in that. I love the druid and the paladin. Oh, those are just such good co-op. I've been dying. So whenever I played Diablo 2, I would always play co-op. I don't know. I think once I played single player, I would always get together friends and play co-op, and I'd always play paladins. And I had this dream of the 8 paladins. If you guys ever want to make that dream come true, I'm
just
totally down for an all paladin full expansion pack 5-act run. I just want to do that once in my life.
We could probably do that.
Yeah, I'll hook you up with my account name. But yeah, you know, stuff like... touching on the co-op, I feel the different ships are much more viable in the co-op setting than the single player, because some of the ships take an awful lot of finesse, like...
The bomber.
Gunner.
Like, the bomber...
Which,
The bomber, the gunner's the one that steers the bullets, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I tried playing that single player, and I'm like, I beat that level, but I didn't beat that level. I managed to dodge enough bullets that I
you
I
were there. Yeah.
You survived the level.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Survival is the fundamental thing we focused on first, yeah.
As soon as you introduce another player, all of a sudden, you know, the guy with the base ship, you know, massive amounts of firepower in a single line across the screen, but all the ancillary enemies that are coming in all over the sides, you know, the gunner can also tack those guys out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The bomber can, you know, start chains and everything. It's synergies.
In our advertising materials, we did focus on, I wonder how many people have really understood what we meant by it. When we said that there were four ships, each with a role to play, that's in our trailer.
Yeah.
Right.
What we found was, we didn't do the classic synergy, like contrived synergies, like say Team Fortress, where the medic can heal other players. Where like there's a direct
correlation.
Player A does something to player B. Player B now is playing a slightly different game. What we did instead was we made four ships that we felt were fairly orthogonal to each other in how they're optimally played and which had different strengths.
Mm-hmm.
And then we made lots of enemies, and we made a conscious effort to make sure that every level had enemies that some ships were strong against and some were weak against, such that when you start actually playing, the guy with the charge ball in a four-player game is going to be the best at taking down the gigantic enemies. He's got the big DPS, but he can only fire so much, and he only fires in a straight line. So you need somebody who has, say, a spread attack to take care of the masses of enemies. And the bomber can create an area of effect around himself by holding down the secondary fire, and all the popcorn that comes at him that's, like, seeking him will just blow up as it gets to him. And all the ships have these places where they're most useful. The gunner naturally falls into the role of medic, basically, because he goes to the side and shoots in. Everyone else dies, but he's off to the side, away from the source of the bullet pattern, and he's doing damage, and he's going to live while everyone else is dying. He's not doing as much damage, but he's got a survivor role that he just falls into.
Mm-hmm.
And what we loved about it was that people just would fall into these roles because it was optimal, not because we'd, like, made it optimal, but because it emergently was.
Yeah.
And that was the product of, obviously, a huge amount of playtesting and tuning. But
yeah.
it was something where, you know, it's certainly true that we were very excited about making co-op as strong as possible, and we wanted it to be, you know, the most fun you could have playing our game. But, I mean, it must be stated that, like, we did care about single player being good as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of the more difficult design decisions we made over the course of the game's development sort of revolved around that dichotomy and making sure that, you know, because you could imagine how easy it would be to, like, you know, jettison the idea of single player being fun at all and, like, you know, come up with yet crazier and more orthogonal and strange ships that, like, were just completely unviable, you know, mm-hmm. to play in single player. And we were constantly aware of how that balance needed to be maintained, that, like, there would be a ship that, like, everyone could agree is, like, a lot of fun in single player, and then some people would enjoy the other ones in single player as well. That was just a very difficult balancing act to maintain over the course of the game. But we were always trying to make sure that, like, single player is going to be, you know, solid.
as much fun as we could make it. We love shooters, and the single player game, I know you guys may be biased against it, but I love single player.
I played most of it in single player. I'm a big shooter player, and okay. I often, you know, I'll play stuff like Dogonpachi. I don't want anyone else there because you're in the way of my...
Yeah.
I can't see where I'm supposed to dodge because you're in the way.
That's why we
made the wide screen aspect.
We did a lot of design decisions around that problem.
And they mess up your chain,
which
they won't in Jamestown because we made our score system something that, you know, and that was a real challenge, was taking, you know, those traditional concepts that don't work in multiplayer in shmups traditionally, and making them kind of work in a multiplayer context, the score system.
And a single-player context.
Yeah, and a single-player context. Yeah. That's true. And sometimes, you know, we couldn't achieve perfect symmetry. Like, we have lives in single-player, and we have the revive system in the second-player. But I think, like, with the vaunt system, you know, not to sound too cocky, I think we did a really good job of
taking
one size fits all.
No, but that's... Yeah. And that was,
one
for me...
One size fits both was the hardest thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and for me, the Vaughn system, I mean, not to go too much into that, but that was, for me, as a person, I've played shmups and, you know, enjoyed them from there, here and there, but, you know, it starts getting to that bullet hell kind of mechanic. I'm just like, you know what, this stops being fun for me because I don't feel like memorizing all these patterns. The Vaughn system, for me, then, was going into this game of, you guys did a great job with the difficulty curve and, you know, get through this.
That's the question I wanted to answer.
Get back to it. You get through those levels, and you're like, okay, you know, great, you got here. Go back and try it now that you've gotten to this point. Try it a little bit more difficult and see to get, you know, and that was great. Like, when I went through it, I was just like, excellent. Okay, I actually feel like I can do this. And the Vaughn system, John Carpenter of Mars with the Dodonpachi and Metal Slug.
Carpenter of Mars.
I don't think your soundtrack is appropriate for John Carpenter.
John Carpenter, yeah.
Your game has a lack of Donald Pleasance.
But going through that, then the Vaughn system was just that one little bit that I was going through. I was like, okay, even when things go really crazy, I can save my Vaughn for that moment where I'm just like, I got no other out because, yeah, maybe there's the point I need to be, but there's no way I can get over there. But from a gameplay then, trying to take single player and cooperative and make them fun, what was the challenge there that, I mean, it's not like all of a sudden you get more bullets or the enemies necessarily get all that much more difficult in a co-op. It's still just there. It's still the exact, you know, pretty close to the exact same. So how is that balance achieved then of being like, okay, you know, we have a second person and usually you think two people, three people, easy.
A lot of it's under the hood.
It's an invisible art.
Yeah, it's most of it is honestly tweaking the enemy life totals depending on how many people are playing in some pretty complex ways. Pretty complex formula that I can't recite off the top of my head.
Which is very seamless, too. I mean, like, yeah. I mean, I noticed playing it from both. I was just like, I really don't notice a difference.
Yeah.
That's
talking about number of players.
Yeah.
That's for the main gameplay. For the challenges, for the challenge levels or the bonus levels or whatever you call them.
Who do I punch for those?
No, I want to shake the hand of whoever did the challenge levels because, in my opinion...
That's a good,
distinction.
It's a good distinction because, from my view of the challenge levels, those are excellent. Like they hook me in to the point of like I know I can do this.
That's why I want to punch them. Like, I can do this. I have the tools to do this. It's not unfair. I am just sucking.
I have to say, I think that Hal sells it short. What he did with the difficulty balancing, maybe you just forgotten.
Oh well, I haven't talked about the.
Well, I was going to say, it isn't as simple as the question frames it as.
Yeah.
It's, we didn't do a lot of things that wouldn't work.
Yeah.
We had to choose the seventh or eighth idea that would actually work in single player and multiplayer. Those bosses, a lot of cool boss ideas we had that would work great with four players, would not work with one player.
Right.
If you look what we did in the third level boss, that's probably our best reconciliation of it, where
yeah.
it scales really well from one to four players, but we scaled it. From one to two
yes.
to three
Very
to four. We wrote it four times, and it does different behaviors in each one. And
going the other way is very difficult, too.
Yeah.
Like, you set up a boss that's, like, totally sweet with four players,
yeah.
and you try to scale it down to one, you know, or
one player to four is actually
yeah.
the hardest.
Oh, yeah, one to four, totally.
One of the big problems we ran into in the game is having enough targets that doesn't happen what happens in Dunonpachi, where people stand on top of each other. So we have a wide aspect, but ultimately people will be drawn and pushed symmetrically. So what you need
mm-hmm.
to do is you need to create a space where there's more than a single target. And there's focused threats that come for a single player. If you look at the first level boss,
yeah.
he's just one target. But he goes to the side, and then 1,000 targets fall from the sky. Additionally, he has the pattern which does the big seeking ball at a single player. So that player needs to move asymmetrical from the other three who need to move to the center. And the beam that does the same thing on the second level boss, and then there's turrets
yeah.
on the sides. We always kept enough targets around that a group of
enough pushes, enough
yeah, that there's only one primary target you have to tend to, so one player can beat it. But there's also, like at a time, but there's also enough targets that if four players are there, they have plenty to do, plenty to get out of each other's way and still be very useful.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, and we did actually do a lot, now that you mentioned it, I'm remembering, too. Now that I'm actually remembering that part of the equation.
Where's like, the beautiful mind formulas that you guys had written up here for?
No, we had to put in a lot of technology. We put in a lot of levels, you'll notice, our sort of version of rank, where if you kill certain enemies very quickly,
mm-hmm.
more threat will come down. And a lot of that was
yeah.
in reaction to multiple players playing at the same time, being able to dish out more damage and clear
mm-hmm.
threat. We didn't want dead air.
And it's not
yeah.
just that they dish out more damage, it's also the fact that they can be in two
yeah.
places at once. So the idea of a single-player game, if you think about how you would design that, the single-player is moving across. We often pull up a threat on the right, and he goes to the right. And then we pull up a threat on the left, and threat on the right. Does he stay here on the right, or does he take care of the imminent threat on the left?
Mm-hmm.
And he begins doing this back and forth. But two players, they tend to take sides and blow things up, which means that back and forth period, which is small, begins to, with the absence of it, begins to make the gameplay feel a little bit stale.
Mm-hmm.
So then we, with a fair, as Hal says, a fairly like hand-touch formula based on number of players, we scale down the enemy life totals and the player damage. Like, we scale up the life totals and the player damage in small ways. But then we also bring in extra enemies in places where we're like, you know what, these are implicitly enemies you kill with a single bullet. And you're just going to have more bullets, no matter how much damage they're doing
mm-hmm.
in a four-player game. So let's make it so that if they're in four players, or really, if they're a single player who manages to kill them all really fast, more enemies show up that have high point value reward. And that creates that incentive.
And also, the way that the enemies target the players
yeah.
Is sensitive to how many players there are. And they tend to, if I remember correctly, they favor players who are not directly under them. Yeah, they tend to fire across the screen.
It's only a couple enemies.
Okay.
I think it's
okay.
one or two enemies in the game that do that.
It's a lot of these, like, hand-touched
yeah.
things. In terms of the actual difficulty balancing, we do where enemies will target from farther away for the single players and for multiplayers.
Yeah.
So, like, if you're on this side of the screen and you're playing at a low difficulty, this tank is not going to shoot at you. But if you're on a high difficulty, it is.
Because
yeah.
cross shots are very dangerous, but they're also a wonderful cooperative moment. Because if there's a big thing on the right that is
yeah.
that is not shooting at the guy on the right, but the guy on the left can't do anything about it. So it's on the guy on the right to kill that thing to stop the cross shot.
Yeah.
So most of the enemies also hold a target till it dies.
Yeah.
So there's some emergent random selection, but even with the random selection, they aren't going to stop shooting at you until they die or you die a lot of the time.
So with all this, then, in terms of the gameplay balance, which, again, like I said, I just I could never really, I mean, for how good it was and how good a job you guys did with all those hand touches, and I could never really feel like that difference, which, you know, is why I think it was just perfect.
We call it the invisible art.
Yeah, yeah. To me, though, then, having to talk about that, not everything was perfect, was the control scheme of getting into co-op for this. Now, from two different sides, because I have two questions. One is just, again, the choices made for local co-op in terms of the control styles, particularly the mouse. The mouse I've never really kind of, I understand the limitations of, but at the same time feels really the toughest to use. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then also, then the second question to go into that then is then why local only?
Okay, we'll get to the second question. Yeah. That's a really great, they're both actually great questions. In terms of the local play, the mouse control was constrained by two use cases that were really important. One is in a lot of mouse play in games, which is common in the modern shmup. The mouse moves at absolute motion. Mm-hmm. The use case we were looking at was scoreboards. Hardcore shooter players, the hardest core players, do not play with mice.
Yeah.
And anyone who can move at an arbitrary speed through the level will get the highest scores, and they will be the best at the mm-hmm. game. So that would mean then taking the players who are most interested in playing for scoreboards and eliminating their competitive edge or competitive ability in favor of probably casual players who would play with a mouse their first play. So we wanted to make sure that we kept the playing field even for all players on the scoreboards. The second one is we wanted it to be the accessible control scheme. Mm-hmm. And we tried a bunch of things out with the mouse control and with the other control schemes, and it is the control scheme for beginners. Mm-hmm. It is as it stands. In other manifestations, it might have been better for maybe an advanced player, but its real purpose for us was, I can play with my 65-year-old father-in-law. We've done this. He has a great time. We're laughing, having a good time. He's playing with the mouse. If he was playing with a keyboard or joystick, or even a more sophisticated mouse interface, it would have been much harder. I played with a mentally disabled friend of mine. They always play mouse. They always have a great time. I play with my wife, who can actually grok the joystick, but the mouse... I'm not even going to...
No, just keep going.
Good. She can. But the mouse play is her preference, and it's a preference I found for most casual players. So we wanted the game to be, again, accessible to... In those play scenarios, as many players as possible. You want to be able to play with anyone who's your friend. So from a co-op perspective, when we had to choose between making, maybe if it even exists, a better mouse implementation versus a more accessible for co-op mouse implementation, because we obviously went with the co-op one.
Because there's not, I mean, this is one thing I went through and tried to find it, maybe I just didn't ever succeed, but there's not like a split keyboard option where two players can share. No. Yeah.
That has to do with,
That's a ghosting issue, right?
No, it's not actually a ghosting issue. The issue with it is, and we're going to get into a rabbit hole here of, I'll say this, a lot of what we did that seems counterintuitive was very heavily motivated. We poured more mental energy into solving the binding problem than I think anyone has ever made a PC game in the history of PC games. I'm pretty sure about that. I spent almost a month on it.
Yeah.
Of my full-time creative energies, and meeting after meeting, experiment after experiment to get it what it is.
I spent like 2.5.
Yeah, I mean, this was a huge feature, by the way, the binding system. Yeah. And we wanted it to be a game where if you wanted to do local co-op, you didn't need to go to an obscure option screen to set up controllers. You could very quickly add and drop players from the game. That was a really important part. We wanted it to be in the central flow, and at the same time, to not be really unpleasant and to pull people out of the game experience. So we wanted to make it as comfortable to bind in as you would do on a console, but to have that work on a PC. The problem with that is the protocols for multi-mouse and multi-keyboard play don't create any bindings like this mouse goes with this keyboard. And the interface for binding in mice and keyboards, or let's say multiple people on a single keyboard, the design problem explodes when you step out of the approach where every device is a player. Where every USB device is a player. Once you try to make multiple players share a USB device,
or multiple devices
For one player?
For one player. Once you break that constraint, the problem becomes unmanageable. You could do it, but it would have taken us more than a month to get going, to really get it fluid and smooth. And we were just like, you know what, we've covered like the 90% case here, getting it so that it's one player per interface device. It's not ideal. We wish we could have done mouse, keyboard, shared control. We wish we could have done multiple people per keyboard, especially because a lot of arcade cabinets, the four controllers come through as keys on a keyboard.
Yeah.
So we do regret that we couldn't get that in, but we had poured so much energy in already to get it as good as it was. We had to draw the line somewhere.
It comes to a place where it's like, do we want to have a fifth level?
That was the question.
Right.
Do we want a fifth level, or do we want to do
those? That's the scope of this game.
Yeah, yeah. It's
yeah, like, if it was possible to play on a regular keyboard in the game, like, with two players without having their inputs always stomping on each other, we probably would have put more energy.
That one might have made it.
Yeah, but...
But, anyway, the short answer is that the constraint space is very complicated when you want to make it feel as fluid as a console, which was our number one goal, and to make it easy to get people in and out.
And I felt that the every USB device as a player is great because as a co-op game on a PC without online play, you are restricted. Like, most people's computers at their desk, most people who have a computer are not going to have two 360 pads hooked up to it. They're going to have a mouse, a keyboard. If they're a serious gamer, they might have a gamepad. And right there, you've got three people playing a game together without any extra.
And that's why the mouse play was...
And most people own more than one mouse.
Right. Yeah.
Right? So, like, that was, again, you know, so much of what we were doing was aimed at accessibility. Mm-hmm. How do we get people, as many people as possible...
To play co-op.
Yeah, to not have an excuse not to try co-op, right?
Yeah. Right.
Like, there's no, like, I gotta go to the store moment.
Right.
If you want to just get some two-player going.
Right.
I promise you can play two-player.
We can guarantee every player who's purchased the game can play two-player, because there's a mouse and there's a keyboard on every computer.
Yeah.
So that's why we wanted to make the mouse play accessible and fun and easy to use and so on, because it is it's a requirement that there be two interface devices. If we made it so mouse and keyboard was like how you played, that would be great. It might feel a little more fluid, but then...
You're cutting out a player. Yeah.
And now people will eventually even just be confused as to how you get two-player working, since you need a mouse and a keyboard per person.
Yeah.
Since we make that distinction, people will more intuitively even know they can do it. So a lot of it's just communicating what's possible.
Yeah,
it was hard to get people to even think about. No, you can plug a second mouse in. No, you actually, it'll work. Just plug it in. It'll work. Just plug it in and press the button.
Dude, trust us.
We thought about even having at one point a multiplayer tutorial where we were like, we put a lot of effort into some really kind of sci-fi new features no one does. Let's teach you how they work, because you don't expect that they're going to work, because they never work.
Just a little diagram. Here's your USB in the back of the computer.
four players. You see these little slots? That's four player slots right there.
The game's, like, you're playing the game and, like, you know, your wireless gamepad dies. You know, and, like, the battery goes, right?
This is something we have, but no one knows.
Like the game will, like, pause and, like, pull up a rewind screen right in top of the game, and, like, you can go in and, like, plug in a new device and, like, come
it'll
back
unplug
in.
It, and you hold down a bind, and it'll bind you in, and you can switch your controls and get back in the game right where you were. Nothing is interrupted.
These are not trivial features.
No, I can imagine. I mean, that's why I wanted to ask, is because of that, is because when you take a look at this, and again, it's the only thing that, for me, when I was going through... I can see the accessibility, but at the same time, the limitation of this, of what's going to feel comfortable for a lot of players. For a casual player perspective, the mouse, sure, but the other players is, I mean, I instantly, like, I saw hands on the keyboard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just, like, right away. And then I was sitting there, and I was just like, but now I can't have someone else on the other half of this and do, like, I'm over here on WADs, and they're on the arrow keys and stuff like that. Yeah.
That feature, just so you know, is extremely likely to happen in the lifespan of Jamestown. That the mouse keyboard, maybe not as much, but the keyboard, like two people on a keyboard, you know, we'd love to put an arcade cabinet up at some point of our game. We're probably going to need that feature for it. So while I can't say when we'd do it or how we'd prioritize it.
Or that it would definitely work with your particular keyboard, because there is just a fundamental limitation that, like, the number of channels...
It's extremely unlikely.
And it depends on the manufacturer and the model, and it's just...
Yeah.
But, you know, if you have a badass gamer keyboard, odds are, in the lifespan of Jamestown, you'll be able to do that. And then our next game, you'll be able to do
that. Yes, I suppose that makes me very excited to hear. But arcade cabinet of Jamestown?
Right.
People have done it. I mean, there are pictures on the internet.
But they can't do more than, like, one player.
Yeah.
And that's sad.
Zipped past before I remember to say it, but
You said you wanted to shake the hand of the man responsible for the challenge level.
Yes.
So
that man is not here.
We all worked on the challenge levels and so forth, but like the lion's share of the real level design,
the building the levels themselves,
was done by a guy named Nate Adams, who is our
intern.
He's our intern.
And we'd love it if you could make sure that his name ends up in your interview.
Yeah, because he worked really hard on those. He turned them around hilariously fast, and the quality level, I mean.
Yeah, at least like 15 through of those levels, I think. I think 14 or 15 of them he just made.
Yeah.
And we would all play test them together, give him feedback, and he, over the process, really learned how to be a good level designer. Like, really good.
A good, like, challenge level for Jamestown level.
And then, you know, he balanced them for 1, 2, 3, and 4 players by hand, which, by the way, if you guys haven't experienced that, every level is completely different with each number of players. So every one of those challenge levels...
That I have noticed.
...is totally different. Yeah.
Yeah, that I did notice was with the challenges.
Like, Partition, have you got to Partition? It's in the final challenge pack. Partition, with 1 player, 2 player, 3, and 4 are, like, totally different. Amazing experiences. They are maybe the best experience you can have in Jamestown is trying to do a 3 or 4 player
through partition. Tim and I just
so
player,
much fun.
Like in a 30-minute meeting, like going over all the challenge levels where they were at. You know,
doing sort of
accidentally spent 2 hours playing. it was amazing.
Some of the best co-op, particularly you can have
the rings levels in particular. The score levels are also. Like, the rings levels are particularly hand-touched.
Yeah.
The score levels also play completely differently, although there's less custom work in them, just because of the numbers and the things you have to do to get the scores.
Well, and to Nate Adams, then, intern of Final Form Games, from me to you, thank you very much for those challenge levels. Mike might feel a little bit differently. Thank you, but he also wants to punch you in the face, so watch out.
Part of what we wanted to do with the challenge levels, part of why we didn't make them softball levels, isn't just because, you know, people love challenges. It's because the game, the main game, the 5 main levels, are the softball versions. And what we wanted to do was to create challenges that would teach people, for instance, how to optimize score in a 4-player game. How do you do it? We give hints at the beginning when you play in multiplayer, and those hints teach you how to actually do it. And even if you don't nail those challenge levels, you've now tried to do something really hard. And when you go and you play one of the 5 main levels, it's all on you. Yeah. But it's not nearly as like rigorous about success.
And we had a lot of ideas that were ideas that like that occurred to us during the development of the canonical game, you know, the main 5 levels.
Wouldn't this be fun?
Wouldn't this be so cool if, like, one player had to go over here to, like, hit a switch to make a door open, the other player could go through, and, like, we had all these ideas that sounded pretty nifty, and we realized that, like, they were totally cool. It would definitely be a lot of fun, but they were going to be asking so much of, like, the players in the main game, you know, who have been fighting for their lives for God knows how long to get to this point, to suddenly hit them with, like, a really tricky, challenging, coordination-requiring puzzle with a fixed camera speed. You know, that, like, either you're going to figure this out in, like, whatever number of seconds or not.
You're going to start this three or four-minute level
again. Right, and we just felt like this is just an unreasonable thing to do. And the challenge levels were a great, like, kind of release valve for those ideas that we could be like, this is a 30-second level. We could put our insane 30-second idea, and then they could do it 100 times and not, like, hate us for it.
Yeah, and I wanted to loop back to what you were saying about you felt like it was your fault that you were failing. That was a huge part of our design philosophy about challenge, about we wanted to feel... We want difficulty to feel like it's the player's fault. We don't want to feel like we are gypping them and cheating them. And that was like when Nate made the challenge levels, I sat him down on several points and told him, like, remember, make it so that the player thinks it's their fault.
Which sounds like a great way to give, like, people complexes.
Yeah.
I'm a terrible way to put it.
Is,
I'm just a terrible person.
Fault is an important word because, you know, it's your fault, that is, you're to blame for it, but it's also your fault, that is, you get to take credit for it when you overcome it. It's
exactly.
You overcame it. You
exactly,
did it.
Yeah.
And that feeling is great.
It's about player agency.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel a big part of a good challenge level is, like, I failed it, I can jump right back in.
Yeah.
And you feel compelled to. I feel, you know, Jamestown did a really good job at the one that I hold up as the big example for how to do it is Geometry Wars 2. It's like,
and Super
Meat Boy. I blew up.
Yeah.
But the A button sent me right back in.
Yeah. That loop you want to keep as tight as you can.
So you have to intentionally, like someone's like mashing the A button, like skip past this. And then they said, well, if someone's going to mash the A button in frustration, why don't we just put them back in? Yeah. They're going to do it again.
Yeah. And they're short levels. There's a bunch of design. Yeah. When you get that confluence of design circumstances, the goal from a design perspective is to minimize that. In between.
Yeah, the turnaround time.
The turnaround time. There's certain situations in games where when you notice, hey, wait a second, this is a under 1 minute experience. It's very difficult. It is the kind of thing where each time they play, they get a little farther, and it's really hard. We should make this a really tight loop on doing it over and over, because this is that class of experience, that class of gameplay. Tim, so we did that there.
Tim put a lot of work into like really making the level loading.
Yeah. The levels are streaming levels. That. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're background streaming on a second thread and decompression on another thread. The whole thing is, you know.
It just moves smoothly. Yeah,
no, there's no loading times. Yeah. You know, actually, the chapter headings aren't even loading. They're just.
It feels like an arcade game.
It used to be.
Yeah. It's like, it feels like cartridge based or an arcade, you know, solid state media or whatever you want to call it. It's just
there.
It's there.
Yeah. You just say, go to this level, play, and there it is. Yeah.
That was an expensive and important goal for us.
Yeah. Another thing worth mentioning that I think is worth mentioning, because you are co-optimists, and the challenge levels are very hard.
Yes.
And the co-op in the challenge levels is very demanding on team.
It is.
And the reason we didn't put that stuff in the main game also is we wanted for every narrative, every story of me and my friends played the main game to be, we did it. Right. We are the best team ever. That is the story we wanted people to take away. And the challenge levels don't do that. The challenge levels have we are the most dysfunctional team ever. We can't even do the simple thing because Johnny always throws the damn vaunt before we're supposed to. As a result, we don't have it to block the shield so everyone can run in through the bullet field. So then we all lose.
Yeah. So in our complicated
in the last 5 seconds again.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas in the main game, we don't put a lot of co-op challenge. The only moment in the main game where you really just have to do a well-oiled machine is the third level boss. If you're playing that, you've got to do that. But even that, I mean, I've played that with people of all skill levels. And the bottom line is, even a real novice can grok it. They can do it. Usually the advanced player will figure out what they're supposed to be doing, and then the beginning player will say, oh, I can do my part. The person who knows what's going on will say, go, shoot the blue thing, blue player, and then blue player will blow it up, and then a triumphant applause, and then they beat the boss, and everyone's awesome.
So, I want to get through a few more questions here before we wrap up with this. And then to follow up with all that then is just having local only. I mean, given the fact that you guys have all the challenges already that we've kind of discussed, but where did it become, and you're going through the process, you're like, okay, we're definitely going to have co-op, so that means we have to balance it like this. Okay, we're going to have these control schemes. That means we're going to have to balance this, and we're going to have to kind of control this. Mm-hmm. What point then you're just like, that's a bridge too far to
that
make
wasn't
it.
That wasn't even how it went.
Yeah.
It was. So we want to do a game with great co-op, so we should put in 4 players. That'll be awesome. But how can we do that without online multiplayer? Well, we can't do it with online multiplayer, so should we cut the feature? No, we shouldn't cut the feature, because we can totally do it local. We should cut the feature, because everyone will want an online multiplayer. No, we shouldn't, because it will be so much fun for the people who can make it happen.
But we'll have to do so much work on accessibility to make that a viable thing on a PC game.
So then we'll have
but
to make a bind screen.
Online multiplayer.
So we'll have to do a bind screen that makes it as convenient as on a console, otherwise no one would ever do it. Hence, we get to why we spent a month trying to make it as convenient as a console to bind in controllers.
Because we started with,
we're
justifying
should we jettison
to do 4-player co-op.
So it wasn't even necessarily like a view of, okay,
we
have this feature
in
which
do it.
It was, we want this feature, co-op.
Yes.
Which means that you're taking it as a whole package of, yeah, okay. Yeah.
So we basically looked at it and we were like, we instantly wrote, we can't do online multiplayer. We've done it before. Me and Mike worked for years on online multiplayer games. We couldn't do it on our own game. With 2 programmers trying to run a company, design the entire game, build all the levels, because we did level design too.
Stand up a custom engine.
Standing up our custom engine, getting it stable, and then to try to do on the multiplayer, we can't do that.
You know, really latency tolerant game.
A platformer or something.
Yeah,
yeah. Without 4,000 bullets on screen.
Right.
Like, it's first person shooters, you know, feel super twitchy and responsive. And like, oh, that must be so hard to get going online. But they're way more forgiving than a shmup. Way more.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you're talking about per pixel collision on
thousands of physically simulated objects on four clients. Like, it's just a completely different scale.
There's no health bar, which means that it's life or death if you're wrong. Error tolerance is inherent in some designs. You have a life bar. A couple bullets hit that shouldn't have. People will assume they got hit. In our game, if you die when you're not supposed to die, it's one error. One stray bullet gets miscalculated and it's over. And the error term is just so high, and the demands placed on it are so high. The camera's always moving, whereas in a first-person shooter, the player can have their camera jump around. What do you do when four players are all scrolling at fixed speed and one of them's laggy?
Right.
What does he even see? There's just... would that even be fun? And that's just... There's that question, right? How expensive will it be? The answer, very expensive. How hard will it be? Answer, very hard. Will it be any fun? Won't know till we've spent all those resources on it.
Yeah.
If it's not fun, we just poured an enormous amount of time. We might have had a three-level game in the hopes that the multiplayer would make it worth it. If the multiplayer sucks, we have a three-level game with shitty multiplayer.
Yeah.
We just could never, there was no, we just couldn't say yes. We were like, this would be so irresponsible.
Yeah.
We can give them a great experience that isn't everything that they want, or we can give them a lesser experience that isn't everything that they want.
Which one is better?
Which one's better? And we just had to go with what we did, but it was hard. I mean, we live with that.
Oh, yeah.
We live with that regret, and we will for the rest of our lives. You know, it's nothing we could do. But we, my friend Aaron Loeb, who I used to work with at Planet Moon, he was the CEO there. You know, that company folded last Christmas. Actually, out of no fault of theirs.
Yeah.
But he was telling me during a particularly dark time at Planet Moon that there are good decisions and there are bad decisions, but there are also tragic decisions, which are decisions that are bad decisions that you don't actually have any choice in. That the decisions that led to that are beyond your control. And so you make a decision that's bad, but not because you think it's good, but because you have to make it.
You think it's necessary.
And I would say that the online multiplayer was a tragic decision. We couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And we wish we could have.
Yeah.
But there was only one actual answer to that question, and it was don't do it.
Yeah.
It was the choice between the lesser of two evils. The choice between two bad things.
Yeah. So, anyway, that's the long answer. And, you know, we don't like to dwell on it too much because it hurts our souls. But
thanks for bringing up bad memories. Yeah.
Ultimately, I think at the end of the day, we did create a great co-op experience, which all the programming power in the world making online multiplayer would not have guaranteed us that.
Yeah.
And so I think that while it may be a little harder to get the game going, what you get when you get it going is worth your time, which is rarely the case.
Yeah, yeah. You have a choice of, do you want good co-op, or do you just want co-op?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That, yeah, I think those kinds of decisions also do come down to providing people, the most people possible, with the best possible experience.
Or with the thing that you care most about as a development team.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's always great reasons not to do co-op. They're always, you know, like, it is always categorically more work. It is always, you know, an investment in something that you may or may not believe in, you know? Like, it's clear that, whatever, Epic feels really strongly about co-op, you know? Like, Cliffy B really loves co-op, and he's like, we're going for it.
We're going to spend millions of dollars on co-op.
We're going big, and we're going to bet hard on this. You know, Valve is like, we're going for it. Like, you know,
games.
6 years on Left 4 Dead development, you know, they're like, this is worth it, you know?
Yeah.
And that is a ballsy move. I mean, I can only get so angry at a team that, like, doesn't...
Right.
It doesn't knuckle up and do that.
Well, the heart of it is also, it's not what every team is there for. It's not what they're about. I mean, for us, we're about co-op. That's something that, if you look, you know, we hilariously made a mission statement when we made our company. And it calls co-op out from day one.
Explicitly.
When we started the company, like, we're signing the documents to incorporate before Jamestown was even a whisper of an imagination. We wrote with an interest in asymmetrical co-op experiences. That was, like, from the get-go.
Yeah.
And that's what we are about, really.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know how Jamestown would ever be that, or if it would, but, you know, it's in our souls that when we saw a way to do it, we were going to do it.
Yeah.
In some form. And it just comes down to what you want to invest the most in. And if you make a lesser single-player experience, and that's what you most care about, in order to create a great multiplayer co-op experience, that's a loss for some teams. And some teams care most about a coherent, complete experience which has no blemishes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they cut features because they'd be blemished. Anything you guys can do to help convey, though, that in the indie world, online multiplayer is a very complex decision and a very hard one to make would be good. Not necessarily to say it's fine they made the decision, but do try to underscore how, like, for, like, one-man, two-man teams, that is, like, if they did it, They deserve a crown and a parade. And if they didn't do it, it may make the game crappy, but at least
they tried.
People know that that was. As for online multiplayer, just for the future, we're always going to be making that decision again and again. We have not written it off for that forever.
Yeah.
We may try to choose genres or premises or games that make it easier for us to give more people co-op because we care about it so much. It's just a question of, what looks like the right decision at each juncture point. Yeah. But we certainly haven't written it off as something we could do moving forward.
Yeah.
We are excited to do it, in fact.
So, along those lines, then, with Jamestown, specifically, you guys are going out to PAX soon, part of PAX 10, which is fantastic, but what's next exactly for Jamestown? Once that passes, because it's been out now for 2 months, and so most game lifespans, you look at it, it's...
Most of them are about a month, really, unless they have a big social component, and then a year for the long tail.
And indie gets that special little category, though, where because of the particular situation that it is, actually they end up having longer lifespans because it is that sort of thing of, oh, someone didn't pick up on it until it goes
Big games with big marketing budgets tend to saturate their market pretty much in the first month. Indie games, because of the lack of exposure and marketing budgets, rely more on word of mouth, which has a slower cycle, and market saturation doesn't happen for usually about a year. I can say what we're looking at for the future is a lot of things. We, our financial situation is always in flux as, a sale goes up that, there's one up right now. What will this mean for our future? You never know. Additionally, we're still finishing up Jamestown. We're not done with it. We want to make it stable for all users, which is an ongoing process for a small team. We want to make it have better performance for the low-spec machines, again, so more people can play it, so the people with machines that are currently under-spec can get in there and enjoy our game. So we want to do those two things as one of our main focuses. We're also working on some content, new content for it. We're not sure exactly what direction we're going to go with the content in terms of how we're going to get it to people, what the scope of it's going to be, but we're exploring a lot of cool ideas that we didn't have time for when we were first making the game, but now that we have a little room to breathe, we're considering ways to get them out to people. So we're working on that as well for Jamestown. And beyond that, we have a couple exciting things coming up later in the year, which I'm sure you will hear about. So, yeah.
Yeah, which was the last question that I had then, is what else are you guys looking at beyond Jamestown? Do you guys want to keep doing this? You mentioned before that you're happy to do this and walk away. Does it look now like maybe we can walk a little bit farther?
Everyone's got their own view on this right now, but from where I'm sitting, I think that we're going to make another game. That's just my own speculation. Meetings have not transpired in which we have said that's happening. But that's where I'm at.
Meetings have certainly transpired where we've talked about that could happen.
Yeah.
But we haven't, settled on, okay, we're doing it. So, my situation right now is I think we should make another game. I think that this has been a big success from all the axes we talked about, and it's been enough of a financial success that saying let's make another game isn't a crazy thing to say. That's where I'm at. And who knows if that'll be more Jamestown, or if that'll be a whole new IP, a whole new project, a whole new world, a whole new genre, who knows? We really are not at that point yet in our future planning, but we are excited about the future right now.
I do. So, the closing, then, that we have, that's like the standard sort of thing, but the closing that we always have to these things is favorite co-op moment of just any time, of any game. Anything.
Left 4 Dead.
Okay, good. You got excited about that.
We're in the sewers. It's me, my younger brother, who's out in California, his girlfriend and his roommate, who's actually not his wife, and my younger brother has not played this game as much as I have. I'm a very experienced first-person shooter player. I used to play competitively in Unreal Tournament back in, early 2000s. So, I'm, like, carrying the team on my back is how I feel about this. And we go into the sewers, and I get caught by a smoker, and I'm dead. And Mac gets beat up, and he's down to, I think, seriously, like, a single life point. And he's, limping along. And him and Zach are in there together, and Zach's only got,
30 life or something. And they're the only people left. Everyone else is dead. And a tank sound plays in the sewers. And I'm like, it's over. And then the zombies horde in. And like, this is the end of the world. They get into one of the sewer tunnels and they actually hold it off and don't die. And get to the door and they bring back me and Shelley. And I'm like, holy shit, we are going to beat this level finally. And so we go to the ladder up out of the sewers. And this has been a very long level. And the tank music starts playing. And I'm like,
oh, shit.
What? I didn't even know that was possible. So the tank starts, you know, it just slaps Matt. He's dead. And I'm already beat up. I'm in the red. And I start hobbling to the safe house, jumping over cars, and everyone behind me is being obliterated and devoured by the destruction of the tank, and we are absolutely dead. And I get into the safe house, and I look back at them, and they're all there being massacred. And then the last one dies, and the tank starts hobbling toward me. I just close the door, and we win the level. And for me, that is absolutely the greatest co-op moment we've ever had, was the learning that your teammate, who you thought was hopeless, can actually save the day in an impossible circumstance, and then knowing when to say, you know, sometimes you leave a man behind.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
Hal?
I don't have as impressive a story.
Should have saved you for last.
Yeah, no. My favorite co-op moment in recent memory was actually playing the Portal 2 co-op mission. So I won't go into too much detail about it, so as not to be spoilery, especially for these guys who haven't played it.
Yeah,
but
I have it in the CD drive over there.
I remember my friend Ben, who's like one of my best friends in the world, was visiting actually just a couple months ago with my wife and me, and with everybody in the Philadelphia area that he knows, and he had not played any of it, and we were playing like the last mission together, and one of the last puzzles, and we had to walk away. We had to like go somewhere else. We had to go to a barbecue in his honor, because he had not been here in many years and lives in Maine. As we walk out the door, and they're like, we're doing everything. We're like jumping, we're portaling, we're using everything at our disposal possible. And at the last moment, I'm like, no. And I explained to him the solution as we are standing outside the trunk. And he's like, yes, that is what we will do. And then, like, and we figure out the solution and then come back, like, 3 hours later and play.
You actually do it.
And I actually do it, yeah.
That's awesome.
That's great.
Parts of that. The end, towards the end of the co-op, when you have to start doing...
Sure.
This is Portal 2 we're talking about?
Yeah
we can't talk about it. I'm
not going to spoil it.
Okay.
When you have to take certain actions simultaneously...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And it's not like we both do the same thing. It's...
We do different things in tight concert.
Yeah. It is bam, 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 bam.
Yeah.
And you win. And you're like, yes.
We're awesome.
Did we just do that?
It's exactly yeah.
It is. Yeah. Portal 2 has gotten some of the. I mean, Mike and I went through the whole.
I reviewed that
together.
One too.
Yeah.
Mike and I have a date where we're gonna sit down as brothers.
We're gonna do it, one sitting.
It is. Even if it's all day, we're doing it.
Fantastic, because you have tons of just utter laugh out loud moments.
I'm ready.
Yeah.
Oh no, it's great.
I'm ready. It's gonna be great.
And there's plenty of opportunities at your brothers, so. There are also plenty of opportunities for real nasty
grief
in the co-op.
We're going to have a great time. That's my favorite part.
You will have a great time.
Yeah. Guaranteed. Is it going to be Gradius 5?
It's not.
Okay.
I have two stories. One's pretty short, which is actually a Jamestown story. Maybe I'll close with that.
Sure, that's probably the way
to go. So mine's also a Left 4 Dead story, as I'm sure many of you here are. And this is, I forget the level that ends where the safe house there's a short bridge, like, that it's a rail yard, and the safe house is a train car, and they're, like, stacked on top of each other, and you're, like, literally walking across the top of one of them, and there's, like, you know, fall on either side to get into the one that, you know, is at the level you're at. And, it's like nighttime. We've gone through this level. There's like a factory you pass through, and it's been very, very difficult. We've almost lost everyone many times. Just Left 4 Dead, and we got to the end, and I was sort of I was, in this particular game, the voice of, like, keep moving! You know, like, yeah. We were definitely kind of pushing against our difficulty level, like, comfort zone. You know, we were, like, kind of working on a harder difficulty than we normally were comfortable playing. And so it was very difficult. And I was, you know, very close to dead, and we got two people into the safe house. I got to the safe house with one life point left. And I turned around, and there was Evan. And Evan takes a bullet right at the beginning of this little causeway. You know, like, right on the other side. Like, seriously, like, 10 or 15 feet from the door. And he goes down. Or he takes a bite, not a bullet. And and I'm standing there, I'm looking, you know, and we have three people in. Like, all we have to do is close the door. And the zombies start to come around him, and I thought, I've got one life point. And I thought, I'm not leaving without Evan. I start, you know, shambling out.
Cover me!
Yeah. Well, I didn't say cover me. I just was like, we're coming for you! And I was like, shooting and trying to get to him. And as I'm making my way down the causeway, zombies start to die because someone has a sniper rifle in the safe house, and they're shooting over my shoulder very dangerously because it's all happening in a very tight sort of, like, cone, you know?
Yeah.
But I get to him, and, like, the zombie comes at me, and down it goes. I'm like, okay, we can do this. And I start to, like, pull Evan up, and zombies are just going down all around us. And, you know, I get him to his feet, and, you know, we're going backwards and shooting. We finally got him in and closed the door. And I was like, that's it. That's the best moment I've had playing co-op. Certainly playing this game.
Mm-hmm.
The other story is we were tuning the challenge levels, and we were trying to get... It was before the score targets had been dialed into reasonable values. They were just, like, winged in, try to get to 1.5 billion points. You know, like, just crazy numbers that hadn't really been tested with multiplayer, and that's why we were playing. We were in multiplayer. Tim and I are very good at Jamestown. We were like, we're going to try to
figure out how good you can get, and then we'll decide a number slightly below that that is a reasonable objective.
And so, we were playing, I think it's the train level, or maybe, no, the barge.
It was the barge bonanza.
It was the barge bonanza, which requires you to special kill. To get the best possible theoretical score, you would have to
You're thinking the rhino one.
Yeah, it's the rhino.
You're thinking the rhino.
Oh,
but the turrets. You have to kill all of the turrets before you kill the main body to get the special kill bonus points, right? So, and it's just like a sea of rhinos coming at you. So, like, this is very, like, you know, micro-optimization, super high threat. And
shoot the small targets, don't shoot the big targets.
Right. And so, you know, it's very surgical and difficult, and Tim and I had been grinding on this thing against this impossible score, you know, that could never be achieved by, like, you know, a reasonable group of human beings. And we must have spent, like, I don't know, like 35 minutes on it or something.
I think it was more like 45 to an hour.
And
we spent a long time in that.
We finally, we were just edging up, and we started to realize that this is actually theoretically possible if we were actually do the Pareto optimal, like,
perfect
run. This could be done. You know, I'm talking, like, you kill the first one and you rush up to where the vaunt is and you're holding down the vaunt button, you're just mashing it so that, like, as soon as that meter gets over the threshold, it'll go, you know? Okay. Like, you're not waiting to see if it's ready. You're just...
When a lot of pickups are falling, you have to, as soon as you get enough pickups to do the vaunt, pull back, turn on vaunt, pick up the other pickups.
Because it'll double the score of the
score rate.
You know, and then, of course, you have to do this simultaneously to get to the 4x score, which, of course, is the only way you could ever conceivably do this. And then on and on like this, and we finally cleared it. And I remember, like, you know, doing the full, like, okay, you know, like, running around the room. And, like,
that's when you do the...
Yeah,
I'm done.
MC.
I'm out. The other time we had that was when we first played four-player multiplayer Judgment mode on
level
2.
I had to leave. I had to leave the room. I've never, like, four-player Judgment, I don't know if you guys have played Judgment difficulty.
I'm not.
You're gonna today.
Judgment difficulty is really unreasonably difficult for certainly someone at my skill level. And
we played the hardest level.
We played the hardest level in the game, which is...
Level two.
And we played it on Judgment. We played it four player. And after one playthrough of that level, my adrenal glands were so maxed out that my hands were shaking, and I was seriously like, it will be unpleasant to continue to play this game. Like, I've never had that happen before in a game where I was like, this is too much, you know? And I had to walk away because it was just, it was... it was stress and terror on a level that was causing my heart to do things it doesn't normally do. And I was like, okay, this is, I'm not going
to
do this anymore.
The lawyers came in here to tell us to shut up. Yeah. It was too intense.
Yeah.
So,
it took me 10 minutes to come down. Like, I,
that was seriously crazy.
Anyway,
you're
going to
experience that today.
Excellent, excellent. Well, yeah, that's going to be then the second feature that we're going to put up with this is gaming with the devs of doing a little bit of dev commentary, having you guys play through, and I guess some of us too playing through,
the judgment run.
And talking to someone about what you guys got family going on there. Guys. That's right, family friend. Yeah, we're going to do a little bit of bleeping, but
thank you for actually.
I want to thank you guys again so much for coming out today and spending the day here and doing the interview with us. And do you guys want to do any real quick Toy Cloud here? Thank you, shout outs to, I mean, we already did a couple.
The big one is you know, to Nate Adams, who made the challenge levels, but also, you know, Tony Palumbo and Noni Nelson,
and Nelson,
who did some artwork for us at the very end.
As well as Morgan Earl, who pitched in sort of heroically at the end on pixel art with me, because it was just too much.
Yeah. And let us not forget our composer of our fabulous music, Francisco Serra.
He, of course, carried us on his back.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's incredible.
May his name be praised.
The soundtrack is something that I absolutely love, but if we got into the soundtrack, this would be a 3-hour interview. So that's the only reason that it didn't come up.
We do.
Soundtrack coming soon. Jamestown.
I was going to ask you guys.
Extended tracks, some remixes, and some extra surprises.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Including a 3-movement version of one of our tracks, which should be pretty cool.
Very cool.
Francisco's been hard at work.
So we're very much looking
forward to the next couple months.
Absolutely. All right, great. Well, thank you guys so much again.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Guys.